Another day, another show, another episode with Access to Perspectives Conversations. And I'm very glad to introduce to you all Anna Maria Bergholz. She's a PhD student in Germany, Cottbus to be precise. And yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Joel. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a great pleasure. Yeah. And we've been chatting in various, well, we've attended a course I've given for the university and the PhD students. And then, we just discovered that we have a lot of shared interests. And I think it's also important for, as I was an international student also during my PhD, or actually I did my PhD in Germany, so it wasn't so international. But before I started my PhD, I traveled a lot. And I was working at the Max Planck Institute, where we had a lot of internationals. So I was basically, let's say, exposed, or I witnessed basically the difficulties. And as much as it's fun and exciting to get to know another country and all of that, but it's also hard work to settle in another country. And another continent for your, in your case, you're coming from Chile, right?
Yes, I'm from Chile.
And at the time when I was myself a PhD student, and there's also a PhD network for the Max Planck and also in other research associations. And we made a big effort to put together welcome packages for the international students, which not many receive or had received until then, to make it easier for somebody. And even if you're a German in a new city, it's always difficult to find your way around with the authorities. But then to add another language is another level of complexity. But so we talked about these things, but also to start with, Would you please share a little bit about yourself, your background, why you made the decision to come to Germany, of all the countries in the world, without weather, and my attitude as a German nation in our complex history, well, dreadful, to say the least. But you're also very rich in culture, which I know you also appreciate. So. Yeah, please tell us about yourself.
Well, thank you, Joe. I was born in Chile, and I studied my bachelor studies in Chile in Valparaiso, culture and tourism management to be specific. And I really enjoyed my time in the university because I got engaged in a lot of activities, and I was working also as a student's tutor, and after graduation also as a professor's assistant, and everything was going great. I was very happy with my professional development. I was working for the University of Valparaiso. I was working in La Sebastiana, which is Pablo Neruda's house in Valparaiso. He's a Nobel Prize in literature. So I was very satisfied with my development. But then even though I was planning already to go abroad, because I from nature, I'm a very curious person. So I always had this intention to go abroad. But I remember that time I wanted to apply for a scholarship or for a program, you know, working and studying. And I was thinking, okay, maybe I can go to Australia, or, you know, maybe I can go somewhere else. And to be honest, I never thought I'm going to Germany. But then I met my husband and that changed everything. I think, you know, that changed everything. It took me a while. It's not that I met him and I decided, okay, I'm going to Germany. It took me like 2 years to take the decision. Because like I said, I felt like really fulfilled in my personal and professional life in Chile. But you know, if I was thinking, okay, I feel this side of my life is complete. I feel great. But in my personal life, I wanted to have a family, and I always wanted to, I think I always wanted to have a family, but I never expressed it like so openly, or maybe I never allowed myself to think, oh, maybe I can have a family, you know. But then I think when you meet the right person, I didn't even thought like this is going to be like, okay, I'm taking this decision. Like, I didn't know what the future would look like. I just did it. So I moved to Germany in 2010. I told my husband, yeah, I'm moving to Germany and it's going to be a real change, because in Chile I was busy and I was doing stuff. And in Germany, it's like, you don't know anybody. Mm-hmm. And you have to start from scratch. So you have to start from zero. And it was a very shocking moment for me. It was very difficult. It was hard. But I told him, you know, I want to continue studying because this is where I feel happy. And I applied for a master program. And thankfully, I got a 6 months later, or I think 6 or 9 months later, I got the place in the master program in international tourism management in Heide, in the University of Applied Science, West Coast University in Heide. Mm-hmm. And so that helped me a lot to integrate myself in Germany and to feel like I'm part of a group again. Because like you said, for students it's a struggling time, it's difficult, but you know, it's also fun because you find other people who are in the same situation like you. I think it's more difficult when you move to Germany and you don't have a plan or you don't know what you're going to do. I think that's more difficult, this not knowing, you know, it's more difficult. And while doing my master's studies, I had the opportunity to do a semester abroad. Mm-hmm. So I decided to go to Guangzhou in China.
Aha, uh-huh. Okay.
Because, you know, I thought, where is the place who is really, really far away and maybe I will never have the chance to see again?
Okay.
So I decided, yeah, I go. I'm going to China. No,
that's a good goal. How was China? Was it because I've been to China for 10 days or something? Was it or 2 weeks? And it blew my mind. Like what we hear in Sanjiu Ru about China is mostly, oh, they're copying this. Oh, it's basically just bad news. Oh, they're violating human rights. As Europeans wouldn't do that. Hello. And I'm not trying to weigh one over the other, but I'm just saying pointing fingers is always easy. But then like the way, like seeing people in their own habit, in their own nation. And then I met a few locals also. It's funny. Mm-hmm. I was on a train. So basically I was on a fellowship also, and we had a visit to Beijing and then also Sichuan. Chengdu, the city I'd never heard of, and I think they have more than 10 million people who live there. Yeah. I just was not on my radar. And it's so beautiful as a city, and the food is so delicious. Like, I haven't eaten anything similarly delicious. Like, the Sichuan food is just for me. So, I was like positively surprised is a heavy understatement. Yeah. Anyways, how was it for you?
You know, I remember my time in China like the best time ever. Maybe before my children were born, of course. But I would say I didn't know anything, you know, because okay, I maybe that's not 100% right. But what I wanted to say is I didn't know much about China. I know I knew maybe what we hear in the news and this idea that we have most, also what you also referred to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I didn't do any research because I had at that time, I had this idea. I don't want to make any former ideas or prejudices. So I don't want to have this preconceived idea. I just want to go there and just to see how it is.
Mm-hmm.
And did that works in one aspect more than the others. That works in because I didn't, I'm not a judgmental person. I think in nature. So I think that helped me a lot to get integrated in different cultures, like, you know, in Germany or in China. It was so easy to make friends. It was unbelievably easy to make friends. And because, you know, I think that the perspective that you have is going to help you a lot. I got there and I was just open to everybody. I was like, oh, hi, how are you? My name is Ana, blah, blah. I got along very well with my classmates and also with the, how to say, Mitbewohner, with my, I was living in a...
Flatmates?
Yeah. Yeah, with my flatmate, because I, and this is the other thing, it's full of surprises. I applied for a one-person apartment, but I got two-person apartment. So that was my first surprise. I was like, oh God, I have to live my entire semester with a person that I never... seen before. So I got there and we got along so well and we are still in touch, and I'm talking about 10 years ago. You know, and we lived 5 months together, and she was just amazing. She's a girl from Russia. We got along very well and we're still in contact. So thank God, you know, I was lucky in that aspect. And the other thing that I didn't lose any minute, because, you know, I saw many were like, yeah, let's go party, you know, or yeah, let's sleep most of the part of the day because it's so hot. And I was I was in summer when I get there, when I got there. But, you know, I was in Guangzhou, that is in South China, and it was very humid, very hot. And I remember the first days, maybe the first 2 weeks, I couldn't really sleep at night because it was so hot and so humid, and the mosquitoes was eating me all over. And I land and I landed in the hospital like twice the first month. First, because, you know, I was very ignorant, so I was like, you know, I think I eat like the Chinese. Like, I will eat it on the street. I will eat this.
Oh, you had a tummy bug. Oh, sorry.
Yes. So I thought, you thought you can handle your food? No, you can't. So, but you learn that way. And I think it's also that's the fun part of life. You know, it's like, I wasn't in life because I'm not that stupid. You know, but I was thinking, okay, so it's, yeah. And I got also in the hospital because of the mosquitoes, you know, I got like, my legs was twice big and my arms were twice big because I also got an infection. So I think in the beginning was most of getting used to this. But once you overcome that part, then it comes the really richness, because I met a lot of people really from China. I was in touch, of course, with internationals, but the richest part for me was to get in touch with locals. And I went out and I saw the cities and I tasted the food. So I had a great time. And I never felt, this is a very weird feeling, but I felt really safe in China, I have to say. Like, I never felt before, you know, in Chile, I never felt that safety being alone.
What caused you to feel safe, you think? Compared to other places, what was it?
Outside, because, you know, coming from, I don't know how is it in other countries in Latin America, but growing up in Chile, I faced a lot of uncomfortable moments, especially the with men, you know, because now I think I changing a lot with the feminist movement and everything, and there's more also governmental involvement in all these policies. Helping women and everything, but growing up it was like you always had to be careful. You didn't know if somebody was going to touch you on the street walking or in the bus, or, you know, I had to face a lot of these uncomfortable moments. Like, there wasn't really it wasn't this feeling I'm safe all the time, and I felt safe, of course, in Germany as well. I have much to say about Germany, but I had some experiences here that also were very uncomfortable. So, but in China, I never had that. Like, you know, once I was in a club in Germany. You know, we were dancing, and a guy just pushed me. I don't know why. Maybe he was drunk. But this really, like, it scares me. So I think in this kind of aspect, like, I was alone on the subway, on the street in China, and I never felt like I'm danger.
And was
so, but that's my experience. You know?
Yeah,
that's my personal experience.
I think I'm like, so I'm wondering if it's cultural, and I'm meaning ancient culture, or if it's because China is such a, or known to be such a highly regulated state, where, you know,
I think because it's highly regulated. I mean, at the time, I think it's also the people had this respect for authority, because if a Chinese person steals from a Chinese person, everybody around will try to take this person and give it to the police. So people is defending themselves. And I saw once in the train station, I saw that a guy tried to take a backpack for someone, and the people just get him and they wouldn't let him go away. And I was like very impressed with this. And the guy who did this felt like really humiliated. So, and then it came the police, and it was quite quiet for a episode like that. So yeah, so I didn't see much of like delinquency or situations like this kind of situations.
Right, okay. Okay, I remembered also before I started my PhD, you know, I was an international student myself in Sweden and then France for 3 months, so I knew what it can feel like. And I think that's also why I was so sensitive to making it easy for the internationals now in Germany when I was doing my PhD. So compared to, I don't know if you're ready to make the jump yet, so feel free to also fill any gaps you want to fill. But compared to the experience you had in China, now coming to Germany, how is that different or similar?
Okay, but I think experience in China was not so long. It was only a semester, like 5 months. So I don't want to compare, because I don't think it's appropriate. I just I can jump to talk about my experience in Germany and without comparison. The experience that I have here in the master program was actually really good. I will jump maybe to the experience to the PhD now, because I have this, I finished my master's, and then I have this family period. So I was like very long away from the university. And now I started by the end of 2021, I started with the PhD program. And it's something that I wanted to do like a long time ago. I had it always in my mind, because I know that BDU had this program in heritage studies, and I knew that from a long time. My plan actually was to finish the master and then go for the PhD. But then I realized, oh, if I want to make this family break, it has to be now. So I had this time for myself, my family, and now in the PhD program, I think it's challenging in some ways, because my case is a very special case. I didn't flew from Chile just to do the PhD, so I'm living here for quite a while. So I think I got used to many things in Germany. I think like you say in the beginning, is quite difficult to make like real friendships. acquaintances, it happens all the time, but these real friendships, and I don't think it's only from the German side. I think it's also from my side, because I feel that I need like a long time to really get someone to trust in someone. You know, I need like a lot. This is a personal thing. Because I see it in my neighbors. You know, with we moved from Hamburg to Rheinbeck, so I see it in my neighbors that they never met before, and then like the best friend, like 3 months ago, 3 months later, I'm like the best friend, and I can't do that.
Yeah, but also maybe it's just,
yeah,
with some people we run into, it just clicks and then it's just easy.
Yeah.
Whereas with others, maybe we are being triggered by past experiences, which
absolutely, yeah.
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out for myself also, because I think the older we get, the more picky we get about friends, because we've already been hurt so many times and disappointed.
It's true.
Maybe our subconscious is trying to protect us from more disappointments to come, which also avoids, and thereby we miss chances of having happy moments before the disappointments come. So the question is, what's the better deal? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it also has to do with ourselves growing as a person and learning from experience and learning also from ourselves. Because, you know, sometimes...
Sorry, I just wanted to add, also, maybe also because the extra energy that goes into, you know, figuring out yourself in a new country, in a new city, in a new workplace. And then there's only so much energy we have as humans, which we can either dedicate to administrative things or invest in building friendships. And you can try both, but it will not have the same opportunity, depending on how much energy or how much resource, how many resources we have available that you now have to divide over. So now I'm thinking analytical.
Yeah.
That's basically our analytical mindset that we've become trained in as researchers, or maybe by nature. But yeah, but keep going. I won't interrupt for the next couple of minutes.
No problem. So I think also we learn from ourselves, like performing in another country. I don't know if we are 100% ourselves, and I don't know in what degree or in what extent we want just to be agreeable and accepted, and you know. So I think that happens maybe, or that happened to me. Maybe that is my experience. I don't know. But when I started to work in Germany, for example, I realized that I will put a lot of efforts in people to like me, you know, or people to accept me, because I didn't want to be like left aside or something. And I realized that that wasn't maybe so right, because I was sure that I can do the job, but most of the time I would be doubting. Like, I don't know if that has something to do that I come from Chile, and in Chile it's like, maybe we are not considered first world countries, so we will look at the global north countries like, oh my god, they are doing everything so right, you know, like they are so advanced and they have everything done, and they create so many things. So when I got here, I was with this kind of thinking, so I don't think that was appropriate, and I shouldn't have a doubt of my capacities, because that really make me insecure. And at the, you know, looking from some years apart, I realized, yeah, that was only part of my insecurities, because I thought I'm not at the same level, but actually I was. And but you know, that's what I said before. I learned about a lot from myself in those experiences. So now I think I have another way to face those challenges.
Well, that's interesting. And I wonder, like, where do you think you were given that information, and how? And it was probably subtle. When you were still studying and working in Chile, how was that image presented to you, that you then manifested in your mind that the global north countries are further ahead, well, probably technology wise, but not with the research capacity only when it comes to staff, but that the research approaches and research workflows would be equally valuable in, like, now that you've seen and experienced, but what made you think otherwise? So I'm trying to figure that out, because that's one of the main topics that I'm trying to tackle also with Access to Perspectives, the North-South divide. And working a lot with African researchers and African research environment, there is often this expectation, the Europeans bring the money, so they dictate how the research project is being planned and executed. Probably they also have more experience in the planning and execution of a big research project, some sort of international collaboration. But how can we... I'm asking myself, where can we tap into changing mindsets on either end, for northern of a European or North American researchers to acknowledge the local knowledge and the, and also sounds dividing, but the knowledge and the research practices that are established and very much valuable. And equally valuable in countries in Latin America or America and Africa and Asia. So not to come with an assumption that everything's better in the West. And on the other end, for researchers in Latin America and Africa and Asia to be self-aware and self-conscious and also stand their own ground for how they do research, and that it's equally important and not minor as compared to. Yeah. I mean, we probably, I don't know, like, I just want to, we probably won't solve the issue today, but maybe if we can just try and analyze and what we've experienced, each of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it has many answers. It's not one answer, it's not one aspect, it's a lot of aspects surrounding this topic. I think it's the way that the education system works, the way that the influence the media have. I think there are many answers, you know, like the strugglings that we have in Latin America may be quite different than the struggles that they are in Europe. I mean, living now in Germany for quite a long now, I mean, more than 10 years, I see also the problems here and I see the struggles here. And yeah, so I really don't have an answer to that question. I think there has a lot of levels of complexity and mixing. But I would say that a good thing that we have is that globalization is helping a lot in terms of the researchers from the global south, or, you know, from more less developed countries can come to more developed countries, and then they can realize, oh, you know what, we also have this body of knowledge, we also have these epistemologies that work for us, for our reality. So we don't have to impose like the way that you do things in developed countries, in developing countries, because they won't work. And I think that happened a lot. That happens a lot. Happened a lot in the past. You will have these experts from you know, from everywhere trying to tell us how to do things or how to solve our problems. And that is what I like about research, and especially about qualitative research, because you have the opportunity to integrate everybody in the discussion. Mm-hmm. You have the possibility to integrate local communities or cities or whatever, and people is have this availability of resources to solve their own problems. So I really like that from participatory methods, for example. And I really like this idea that everybody can be an expert where they live, and where they surroundings are. So I think that this is a good aspect of globalization that has helped us to get to know each other, to have a closer look to each other, and to understand that we don't need this. We don't need in that totally this expertise from the global north or in all the subjects. We can also rely in our own body of knowledge. So I think that's a good thing. And I see it also in the PhD program, and I see it also in conferences when it's getting so intercultural and it's getting so international. And I really like that. I think it's the way that we can enrich research. And yeah, so.
Yeah. I think also language, so thanks for sharing that. And I know for a fact that we know, both of us know how important language is. And when I hear Global North, Global South, we spoke about this, was it just 2 days ago? Might carry information that is also historically loaded by assumptions that, or when we talk about more or less developed countries, can we specify that we mean technology and nothing else? If we have to use the term developed or underdeveloped or whatever, it's also relative and it's very subject specific or centric, Eurocentric, Northern Western centric, whatever. Because, I mean, where has technology brought us really? Now we're able to blow the whole planet into pieces. Great. And we know that technology is very, very much is basically depriving us of our livelihoods on this planet. So is it really a win with all the comfort, and the comfort is only for the few, to make that comfort for the few happening? 80% of the population on this planet suffers as a consequence or as a starting point. Like, to me, that's not an achievement, really. It's a status, maybe, but nothing we should, anyone should continue aiming for. So I think also with research now and open science, now we have the opportunity, and also thanks to globalization, like you said, to shuffle the cards anew and give everybody a new deck of cards to change the game and the paradigms, and to develop into a way together and inclusively where everybody, like every researcher from any part of the world, can contribute their aces, like their best achievements and their best knowledge, or most, whatever that means now, but the most sophisticated and well explored. And with that, I also mean indigenous knowledge, because that's something that I'm also personally interested in, also professionally. And thankfully, I'm not only one, and there's no institutions like the UNESCO who call for including indigenous and traditional knowledge system into the solution finding for the global challenges that we have. And then I just wanted to also, like what we said on Tuesday in our conversation, to prepare for this meeting. When I how easily it slips our tongue, like when I was asking you I was referring to Americans, meaning you as Americans, and then I was asking you, all of a sudden it hit me, like, but you're American, what am I talking about? You're from Chile, and that's very close to America, as we know, like the territory geographically. So how is it? And then I was asking you, how upsetting is that really for you? Do you want to go into that just with a few sentences again? Or what's your strategy now that you?
I used to be upsetting, but I think not so much anymore, because it has been so accepted worldwide that they call Americans to U.S. citizens. I mean, it's everywhere. It's in the news. It's the way that countries refer to you, to the United States. The way it's portrayed in movies. So I think like they kind of accepted this. They just took over the continent, like, yeah, it's America. But yeah, I don't know. You know, when I faced this, I just try to engage in the conversation, say, oh, you know, I'm American too. Oh yeah, really? From where? I'm from the South. Oh yeah, maybe, I don't know. New Mexico, South California. Oh no, more southern than that. Oh, really? Southern than that? What can that be? Oh, I'm from Chile. And they're like, you know, a little bit shocked. Like, huh? Yeah, of course.
That's not in
And
America. Yes, it is.
Chile's in America. It's in South America, but America is a continent, you know. So I think that as long as you know how to deal with that, and you know, because when I read this in the paper, or when I saw this in television, and a really renowned television shows or programs, or I would say, oh, I'm going to write a letter, because you know it's not appropriate that they say this is in America it's like that. That is just too broad. That you cannot say, even inside of the United States, you cannot say in America it's like this, because it's so big, it's so different from state to state, that I don't think it's appropriate to call United States America.
Yeah.
But it's like I said in the beginning, it's worldwide, like. They just accepted that it's this way. So, yeah,
yeah, it's
I don't
funny
know.
how economic power seems to grow in our minds with the extra size or how much a country or nation occupies in our view. Because we have these discussions with, it's like, in with African researchers or research projects or anything. So with Africa and international research projects, even if the project is with one or two countries, and then it's Germany and Africa, even if we're just working with one country or maybe two, can you name the country? Because if you look at the size, Europe alone is tiny, and yet
yes.
They compare, or they put the whole continent with all its diversity, challenges as nations, economical situations, research capacities, which are highly diverse, across. And there's like and anyways, and there's also an organization called Africa is a Country, where the answer would be, hey, can I remind you of, it's actually not a country, it's a continent, and we're talking 54 countries and then other states as well. Oh, just to call to the attention that what we're doing with our language. But that organization, Africa as a Country, is basically a political organization calling out on the Western view we have on Africa and its citizens and its political schemas, which is like often just rude, like what we have of China. So politics. But
you know, I think it's an excellent point, the one you are doing, because it's a way in which how we use language to represent realities. So we have to be careful, and that's why I like research. Because
awesome research.
What
I have
research?
To stop you right there, because awesome research we take all the time. And medical research, like not being specific, what is the research on?
Yeah.
Where was it conducted? What are the samples? Who was interviewed for qualitative research? What's the representation of a global society, if anything? If it's only Germans, which Germans? Germany is also a highly diverse country, culture-wise.
Yes.
Are you measuring women against men? What about all the other genders in between? Maybe not in between, but... So I think it's on researchers in particular to take charge of being aware, and that's where the knowledge is or should be in the first place, if nowhere else, when it should and must be and actually is at least accessible in academia. So why, I think we can do better from what we see published. Sorry, but yeah, go ahead.
I totally agree. It should be, you know, like good research. good research. It should be very specific. And I was discussing with her the other day, with, also with my classmates, like, we cannot say, we should be very careful when in generalizing, you know, we shouldn't be say, it's like before I told you, like, you cannot even say this is happening in America, because what we know about America, we hear a lot of from Los Angeles, from New York, you know, from the big city, from Washington, but what happened with the other parts of the United States, not from America, because, you know, what happened is in Canada, or, you know, and so we, oh, exactly, when we hear references about Asia, when they say in some part of Asia, okay, in which part of Asia?
Can I just say, coming back to the United States, I just learned yesterday, apparently for the US Americans, there's a term from where they live and grew up. It's called flyover states. They don't even give themselves names anymore because it's just a state they tend to fly over if you, as you travel from east to west coast, as if they don't exist. Like, what? So okay.
Yeah. So, and yeah, we can find differences everywhere, you know. If we go deeper and deeper, we, especially in my field of study, you know, in heritage studies, we, I read a lot about when people speak about communities, even communities are heterogeneous in nature. It doesn't mean that if you have a community, even if it's a small one, you won't find the same meanings or the same thinking in everybody. It's going to be diverse because that's our nature. We are diverse, even in the same. I cannot say, I told you, I've been telling you a lot about this. I don't think I represent all Chileans. It's not possible. I don't think I represent all researchers, foreigner researchers researching in Germany. I don't. We, you know, we can give some perspective because this is a lot related to who we are, what is our background, what is our stories, what is our genetics. We carry with us all this knowledge, and this is the way that we construct our realities. So I think that should be portrayed also in the way we talk, in the way we discuss. But we are living in a time in our society that everything is so rushed. You know, everything is so in the now, and you have like news every hour. It's, there's no time to editing. There's no time to slow down and to think about this. So people is just, you know, I even myself, I'm listening the news and I'm like alarmed because, you know, 2 hours later it's worse, like 3 hours. Better not to listen, better not to read, because at the end is you're going to be so overwhelmed with all this information that, like you said, most of the time is just it's misinformation. It's not well informed. It's not, we hear, and in Asia is happening this, and in Latin America is happening this. Okay, it's so big. Could you be more specific? Could you specify? Because then everybody is so afraid to travel there. It's not the same. You know, every country is different. Every reality is different. And it is so complex. We should really avoid generalization.
There's also, we have the same challenge in research with the publication pressure, and there's actually a term now for slow science, meaning allowing research again to be slow, because good research does take a whole lot of time. But a PhD student tends to only have 3 years, and hardly any PhD student I've met, including myself, manages to finish within 3 years, because it's just crazy. And then you also have to publish 2 or 3 papers within the time. Like, it's just, what? Unless some other PhD students has laid the groundwork for you and you can just put the pieces together.
In the time we have as a PhD researcher, like 3 years is also like very,
it's very short.
It's very tight.
But so from a meta perspective, like, because I'm also working on the kind of research management side of things, and things are changing to the better. So like we're trying to figure out how can we assess research with quality measures, and that's hard to define for all the disciplines, all the research projects and topics. So unfortunately, we don't have like the quantitative is an easy measure, like how many papers have you published in what journal. It's just not helpful. It's a sickening system, and it's brought us to not a good place, which causes a lot of mental issues also in the researchers. Because it's just too much pressure, and it's nonsense pressure on top. And we want to do valuable and meaningful research, but then we're being pressured to publish just for the numbers, and that doesn't make sense. So for the research culture, did you see differences, or are you still in touch with your colleagues or with researchers in Chile to see how the research culture works in Chile versus Germany, knowing that the pressure is also on there, but maybe there's still some, I don't know. I wouldn't say we've lost all the good research culture aspects in Germany, but it's hard to maintain. Or even from what you've seen in China, like all the different places. Because what I've seen in Sweden is that also with regards to managing work-life balance kind of thing, the Swedes are so different from how they treat their staff generally, but also in a research environment where people come between 9 and 10 to the lab where I was working, then they have a 1 hour lunch break, then there's a 3 o'clock coffee break, and then they leave at 5 because they're picking their kids from the kindergarten and school and whatnot. So Sweden apparently manages, it's not perfect either, but it manages to at least give some ease of mind to and be family friendly more than, like, way more than Germany is. I tend to say they also have fewer people to worry about, because Germany has a whole lot of other issues to deal with. The education system is certainly not the first priority, unfortunately. And we, yeah, that has consequences. But okay, but what's your...
I remember when I was working in Chile back in, there were more room for, but I don't want to generalize, this was my experience, I just have to highlight that. We had a lot of room for creativity, and we could experiment, I would say. So for example, my personal experience was because I was working in the in culture and tourism management, so we really had the opportunity to get in touch with local companies, and I could take the students to these companies to analyze how they work. So they were they were working together. So the companies would show students how they work, and the students would analyze them. So it was like this, we were helping each other, mm-hmm. you know, this the cooperation mm-hmm. kind of working. And I also in the university, so I think it, at that time in this specific case, there were a lot of room for improvement and creativity and to experiment. Like, how can we create a better work educational environment? Because it was management, so this concept of learning by doing was a lot of, in most of the discussion in terms of education, so there was this integration. And in terms of research, it was also intense. In terms of writing and to keep publishing, but I don't think at that time was so pushed and stressful like in here. I think this, even though the work, the work structure in Chile is also like work, but we will have like a nice pause in the middle to lunch break, you know, and we will have some time, and we will have at least 1 hour, because, you know, we want to just chill a little bit, to relax a little bit, and then just come back. But even the working hours in Chile are insane. I mean, they are really long. Because also the structure the social structure at that time, I don't know how it's now, will help you, you know, like mothers will have the help from the families. So there's a more like, if, in that concept, it's not that maybe you will have your children in kindergarten, you know, in baby care, but you will have your support from your family. You will have maybe your mom or your, you know, your sister or someone in your family that will help you. Here in Germany, my experience is that you are most on your own if you have families. So I think the first thing for the working mom, this environment of work is very hard. Even though you can work like a part time, like 20 hours per week, 25 hours per week, but I still think that you will be judged for how much you do in the work. Like, of course, the person who's there full time and every day and doesn't have to leave because, you know, you have to pick up your children from school or you have a sick child. I still think that we have this more like traditional way of seeing or perception of work, like someone who's there, like most of the time will be promoted and will be, you know, supported. And I mean, that is what I've seen. So, and like you said, I think Germany really has room to improve in terms of education and in terms of families. Like we should be the core of society, but what I see, this is my opinion, in Germany is very individual concentrated, like what is the best for the individual living more than for a family perspective. And that makes difficult also for, in my case, I am a mother and I'm trying to be a researcher and I, you know, you have to work with the time you have and you can do, you are trying your best, but the time is always there, you know, like you have these time constraints and you miss also some opportunities because you cannot, unfortunately, if you're doing your PhD and then you want to work, how you should do it if you have only 3 years to do your PhD and then to have a job and then to have a family, it's almost impossible. One of those three things are going to less in production and are going to be left aside because it's just not possible. And I see it even for my classmates that don't have families, they're also struggling, you know, because they had to have a job if they don't have funding for the projects. They have to work and they have to do the PhD and they're always divided between these two responsibilities. And even though you think, oh my God, it's the whole week, I haven't written new pages or, you know, I have to read this very interesting book and you wouldn't have the time because you also have to do your job in order to get the money to pay for your living in Germany. So I think there are a lot of topics around it, difficulties or constraints that you will face, not only as a foreigner, I think for working moms in Germany, I mean, German moms, that it's also like this. When they ask me, you know, what did I do? I'm doing my PhD. And like, what? A mom is doing that? How you do it? Like, it's like, you're an alien because you're a mom and you're trying to do something that is difficult, even for someone that has all the time to do this. So, I think in general is, and the push that you mentioned with the publishing in China was also this way. Like they were very productive, like writing like crazy and sleeping in the library. I saw people sleeping during class. So, they are really pushed.
Wow. Yeah,
it's not a healthy environment. I would say it's not a healthy thing to do. But it's with the rhythm. We really need this slow, or maybe to go a little bit back to the slow work, or maybe this perspective. It doesn't have to be so rush or so competitive.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I feel it's also a question of time management, but the time management responsibility should not only be with the individual researcher, but also the institution needs to have an awareness that people have families and and those that don't have a family of their own, they also have relatives and usually parents they need eventually to take care of. Also friends, they like friendships they have for their own well-being, they have to spend time on to nurture. And holidays, I need holidays, like for sure. So I think a workplace, and very much so also academia, needs to provide room and also remind their staff and their people to take charge of also their personal lives, not only their professional lives. Because like reminding us as the individuals of, oh, yeah, you just need to manage your time better. But with all the pressure coming from the institution, how? Like, that's humanly impossible in some many circumstances. Did you ever feel you had to decide? I think I heard something like that earlier when you spoke. Did you feel you had to decide between family, like having a family, having kids, or your academic career? Or was it always clear to you, you will find a way forward to manage both?
I definitely, when I want to have children, I had to decide. Because at that time, my German wasn't that good. So my working possibilities were quite limited to international jobs. And even though I work between my two children were born between that time, but before that, I finished the master program and then I told my husband, okay, now we should try to have a baby, because I wanted to really have the time for that. And I think that's also is a privilege. I mean, let's be honest, in our time, if you want to have a baby, most of the time you will continue working. Because you know you have to save money for your retirement, and in Germany this is a big deal, because you really have to think in your future, and oh my God, when you're retirement, would you be able to pay the rent? Would you be able to live well? And so this is like very concerns in Germany. So I think for me it was like, I'm not going to look for a job because I know that I can't deal with the stress. So, and I really want to take the time, and that was a privilege. So I had the time to have my baby, and I was with my daughter at home for at least 1.5 years. And then I contacted one of my professors in the university where I did the master, and I wrote him and I was like, you know, I'm just looking for an internship or for an opportunity. If you can give me a job when I can work 20 hours, I will be really grateful and happy to do it. And he said, of course, I would offer you possibilities. So I started with the internship, and then he hired me. So I worked there because I have this contact. But it's very dependent on what your circumstances are. So I think in that case, I have this luck that I knew someone who put me in a position, you know, who put me in a company. And I think you always need these connections and this network. Because if you do it on your own, you don't know how it's going to be, and you cannot decide. So I think it was like that I had this contact, and I worked for this company for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to add, I don't think you were lucky, you were proactive. So you were taking charge of the opportunities that you saw lying in front of you. And I was very hesitant for many opportunities that I saw, because I always felt like, oh, I'm not good enough, or this is not for me, or I don't know. But just go for it, and also to be proactive to openly ask somebody or reach out, hey, I enjoyed the working with you, and now I'm in a position to take up work again after I spent, you know, after time off for the children. Do you see any possibilities? Proactive, and that's usually rewarded by the universe or just by physical or metaphysical laws. Like, as you take action, not everything might be replied positively, but there's always other opportunities that are coming your way as you move forward. Mm-hmm. So instead of sitting there and hoping for something coming our way with which would be easy sitting in our comfort zone, but it actually matters to reach out like you did, and then that's when opportunities arise. So I wouldn't call it being lucky necessarily. Of course, that the circumstances need also be right, that the person you're reaching out to has the capacity to provide you space and money eventually to work for them. But if not one, then probably the other will have that.
Yeah, you know, now that you mentioned it, you just hit me, because it's true. You know, I think it has a lot to do with my background, because I wasn't supposed to go to university because my parents couldn't afford it. So I just started to work at a very young age, because I realized, like, very young, oh my God, I'm poor. So I have to do something to go to university. So I started to work like a very young age to pay for my education. So I think that has been like the way I confront life. You know, it's, I had to do something to reach my goal. I have to be proactive. And even though with the PhD, because, you know, after I had my daughter, and around 2016, I said, oh, you know, I really want to apply for the PhD. And I had my my proposal written, and I wanted to apply, and then I got pregnant with my second child, and I said, okay, forget it, because I can't do both. And it's the same thing. I didn't want to have the stress. I wanted to concentrate on my child. What, you know, I really believe in this thing, one thing at a time, because if you concentrate in many things, you wouldn't have the energy to pay attention to anything. So I want to concentrate in my child. So I have my second child, and then, but you know, time is ticking, and I was like, oh my God, maybe I'm too old. The gap is too big. I'm too away from, I haven't published anything. Oh my God, I don't have the chance. And then I say, okay, I'm going.
That's what we hear. I also heard that, oh, to be successful in research, you have to stay on, like, and like losing 1 year, you're out of the system. It's not true. People, like researchers, change topics, meaning they start from scratch in a new research field, you know, sometimes late in their careers, and they can still be successful, because nobody can take away the experiences and also the logical capacities that we've built, even from primary school. Like, it doesn't get lost if we take a year off doing something else. And running a family or managing a family is a lot of project management. So you can also apply those skills that you establish in coordinating, managing the household. It's very similar, if not like more or less the same, for the workflow that as we experience or have to coordinate in research.
Yeah, but you know what, Joe? We really need to find that information somewhere. So if you can write a book about it, that would be great. Because it's very difficult to find those experiences. We are just surrounded by, you know, this successful story. I am so successful. I did this like in 30 days. You know, it's like, oh my God, we're just bombarded with these successful stories. We really need more struggling stories, you know, like how somebody started from scratch. We really need those stories, because we always believe, oh my God, everybody's doing everything, and I'm here, and I'm, you know, oh, what is going to happen? And you're absolutely right. It's, you know, after my second shot, I said, okay, the possibility is over, because the gap is too big. I was way too many years away from academia, so I'm going to get a job. And I got a good work at a private institution, but I wanted to stay in education, you know. So I got in a private institution, and I was working there. Also, I was in touch with professors and with students, and it was a great experience. And it's funny that I mentioned this, but, you know, I remember I went to the Chilean consulate, because I had to do something like I need a certificate or something, and I explained that they asked me, you know, what are you doing? I explained, oh, you know, I got this job, and I'm doing this and that, and they were like, oh, but you know, that's a great job, you know. It's like, I would say, yes, of course it is, but you know, because normally Latin Americans are not, they won't see you like, oh my God, and he got like a really management position. It's like they expect you to do this, like other kind of jobs, like lower position and so on. So I was thinking, okay, that's also this kind of thinking that we cannot do more. I don't like that. But anyway, that's just a parenthesis, you know. What I really wanted to tell you is, like, I was doing this job and then Corona came and I was losing my position because, you know, first in, first out. And what I knew, okay, they offered me to stay, but when I was working there, I was always thinking, why I'm not trying to do research again, because that's my passion, that is what I want to do. I feel so comfortable and I have also this intellectual need. I know it's in myself and I was struggling because I was suffering, even though the work was great and my colleagues were amazing. I had an amazing experience there. It was great, but inside me, I was like, why I'm not writing anything? Why I'm not creating something new? So when I knew I'm going to lose my job because it's Corona and, you know, a lot of people lost their position as well. So I contacted the university. So I wrote the university and I got an appointment with the coordinator. And the first thing I asked was like, tell me the truth. Do I have a chance? Is the gap too big? Am I too old? Is it possible to research with family? And I'm a foreigner, but I'm a German, but... You know, I'm a German on the paper, but I was born in Chile. So all this during the mixture of experiences, and she was like, of course you can. Who told you you cannot? But of course you can. Just send your proposal. We will see. And even though this process took a lot of time, because it took me time to come back, it took me time to write the proposal and to get familiarized again with the research process and with methodologies and with school of knowledges. So at the end it worked and I feel very fulfilled. So yeah, I'm happy that I acted proactive again to
yeah,
achieve that.
Being rewarded, taking charge of our lives. And also, like you said, like feeling, even though we're being told we have a good position and we cannot appreciate it, but to be aware or become aware eventually of our purpose and our calling, like what you really enjoy doing is everyday practice, how you want to work, knowing that academia can only provide for that, but why is there maybe other organizations outside academia that can provide a similar work ethics? And that's shifting all over society sectors, but so we can also design a workplace for us and find the best possible fit. But I agree, like academia is a unique place to be in. It's very elitist, not necessarily monetary wise, but it's also not meant, I mean, I don't know, not saying that it's only for the chosen few, but it requires a dedication, a personal dedication to be willing. But yeah, so what is, okay, so maybe concluding, as we've touched on the various aspects, challenges, opportunities in academia, besides academia, balancing work life, if you and I try to make a short list of the usual challenges, and then you said you wanted to share also how you're tackling those and finding inner peace for yourself despite or with the challenges. Also, a challenge-free world would be really boring. It's just a matter of how we approach them and learning resilience or being resilient about them. And I think it's also a matter of personal responsibility as a word or a term that I only recently embodied for myself. Like, we are personally responsible to how we feel in our lives, and then we can also make informed decisions how we want to change certain things, or what we can also expect from a workplace and the managing people in the workplace. We don't have to take any distasteful piece of meat or coverage that's being handed over. I don't know, I'm making funny images now. But it's like, I think it's also a matter of personal responsibility in the sense of knowing what we want and what we enjoy doing and what we are ready to deal with to a certain extent, and where do we draw a line? Mm-hmm. Well, that's still manageable and that's too much to handle, so I'm leaving academia, or I'm leaving this group, or I'm focusing more time on family because that's what I need for my own well-being. Mm-hmm. So what's your current approach? Not saying that this is the final, like, I think we are all constantly adapting, so I'm trying to say, but what is the final strategy will only be final when we leave this lifetime. So what's the current strategy that you found for yourself to deal with the challenges that you've seen?
I think the first thing is that you have to see yourself in your inner. So inside yourself, like, you have to really know who you are, has been your path, what was your background, what you have achieved, what have you overcome, what difficulties have you overcome, and so you really have to be aware of what has been your way till now, and on that part, you know, like, and I think it's also, you have to love yourself and to forgive yourself and to be kind to yourself, like, to understand yourself and treat yourself like this inner child that is constantly with you. And this inner child was also doing all this along with you. So I think doing peace with yourself is the first step. I think there's another thing that we have to consider, like, what are the resources that you have? Because, you know, I'm fortunate that my husband supports me, but imagine single mothers, or imagine people who are alone and don't have families, or don't have support, or don't have family, or don't have a job. So it's very also dependent on the circumstances. And the other thing that I think is very important is we have to get away from the constant, this temporary satisfaction. Like, if you want results, I want results now. I want results today. No, we have to postpone the reward. You know, we have to postpone the reward and to see what you're doing is... You know, I this is very short, but I watched yesterday a psychologist, and he was explaining about the difference between the pleasure and happiness. And he said pleasure is temporary, but happiness can be a lifetime with you. So the pleasureness gives you this dopamine, which is the constant reward. You know, I'm going to watch something, or I'm going to eat something to make me happy now because I'm too anxious, or I'm too worried. Don't have too much excess of future. You know, to live in the present. Just one day at a time, one day at a time, to live the now. Where am I? What I'm doing? And these are not my words. These are words from the psychologist I'm reading, you know. And to concentrate on that, and to live one day at a time, and to postpone the reward. You know what I'm doing now, it doesn't have to be a reward tomorrow or next week or next month. Of course, in the case of the PhD, the reward will come later. So if you have that state of mind that is telling you everything you are doing now is going to have a purpose in the future, it's fine. It's just going to be fine. Just concentrate and put quality on what you are doing right now. Take care of yourself. Don't have too many expectations, and think positively, like, be happy with small things, and don't compare to your others. Just compare to who you were a month ago, a year ago, 10 years ago. And if you're happy with the development, just continue doing what you're doing. Yeah. Keep going.
I think they like I've also learned that concept recently in a business development course that I'm taking, and they talk about the day you plant a seed is not the day you harvest the fruit or eat the fruit even. So harvest comes before then. And that's very much true for research experiments and workflows. And also, yeah, oh, it could go on forever. But what I want for that. Yeah. And then also when you say like looking at the rewards, can we not also can we also see reward ourselves for the accomplishments? Like, well, I like appreciating what we accomplish over a day and feeling satisfied that we've actually done the work and rewarding ourselves that day, that moment, so that we have not only a feeling of accomplishment, but also allow ourselves and celebrating the accomplishments.
Yes.
And rewarding ourselves in the sense of also some time off, like, okay, now I entitle myself to spend time with my family and friends, and that then gives me energy again for another day to plant
yes.
more seeds and to eventually harvest and then eat the fruits. So I think that's also important.
Yeah, absolutely.
To only live in the now and work in the now and then wait for some future to eat the fruits, but also eat some fruits that you can already buy in the market in the meantime.
Yeah.
And the market
yeah.
being like any leisure activities, you know, going climbing, mountain hiking, just chatting with your best
yeah.
friend.
And what you're mentioning, it goes hand in hand with the importance of relationships. Because, you know, I listened from a coach, from a Spain coach. I think it was a volleyball team, I'm not sure. But he said, if you want to advance rapidly, you should go alone. But if you want to advance to get like a really big accomplishment, you should go together. So I think the importance of relationships are huge. Yeah. What I mentioned before about the reward is like we live in a society who expects everything to get now. Like, you know, our parents used to work like 30 years and to buy a home, and we want to buy it now when we are 30. That's what I meant. Like, you don't need to, you know, you don't have to have this obligation that you have to do things. Because everybody else is pushing themselves and is stressing them out and to do those things, but you can have your own approach to happiness. Your happiness can be to walk out with your dog, or you know, you are the own owner of your happiness. So yeah.
Well, that's a perfect final statement, because not so much coincidentally, but we have an episode that's already published on Being a Happy Person by Sarah Hefti. She's a friend, colleague, and she specialized out of her own life experience in dedicating herself to be happy, like deliberately. And happiness is work. Feeling happy in the moment is quite a bit of work, and it's so rewarding. So you can work towards being happy, not 10 years from now, but today and tomorrow. And it takes effort, but you'll feel happy, and that's like the best feeling ever. Happy in the workplace, happy with the family, happy. And I think it's being aware and dedicating time to find energy to go and experience stuff, to meet new friends, new people, to spend time with your family deliberately, making room in your calendar for your kids. And that sounds very mechanic, but it opens opportunities for connecting with the people that we love and are also responsible for, to make them happy. And they can only be happy when we are happy, and we are happy when we make time for happy moments. And the happy moments can also be in the workplace by being appreciative of and purposeful also in the work we do. Like checking in with our value systems and knowing that we are actually enabled by the institution to work according to our personal, ethical, and value standards. And there's quite a bit of contradiction there in the current system, but there's also still a lot of opportunities that have persisted over the years and over the pressure points. So yeah. Would you like to add something for that closing remark, you know, dialogue?
Just thank you for the opportunity to talk about these topics, and yeah, maybe we can have another episode.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome, so much topic. Stuff. Like,
so, it's so much fun to talk to you. So thank you, Joe.
Oh, it's likewise. Like, I learn so much every time, and like in the podcast generally, and also with you in particular. So you're always like, you're welcome back anytime. And yeah, and we're like, I think I can speak to on behalf of us, some if not many or all of the listeners, we wish you all the best and hope to have you back in the show sometime soon. Hearing about your accomplishments, like how you continue to pave your career and building a meaningful, or continue working a meaningful life. What? I can't make sense now of my words, but I'm trying to say, welcome back. And I'll be in touch.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Joe. Bye bye.